Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
In addition to interviewing scholars about their research on various aspects of religious behavior and organizations, one of the things I like to do with this podcast is talk with practitioners, people who live out their faith on a daily basis and or who are chest deep in running organizations that are faith-based. It's my firm belief that we can all learn a great deal from these folks who are in the trenches, as they often have insights that many ivory tower academics overlook. To that end, we have featured missionaries, directors of charitable organizations, lawyers who manage church conflict, and even a cowboy preacher who ministered to itinerant rodeo riders, one of my favorite all-time episodes, by the way. It is in this tradition that today we have a very interesting guest, Jeff Hennig, who was recently appointed as a state prison chaplain in Arkansas a few months ago. Jeff describes himself as a former group home slash foster care kid, a Marine Corps grunt, and a convert from the New Age movement who was baptized into Christ on July 31, 1989. He also has extensive musical talents, which is, interestingly, how he became connected with prison ministry, a story which I believe he will fill in for us. Jeff, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me. I am very honored that someone would find something that I do to be that interesting. So,
this is one of these jobs that you're one of my Facebook friends, and this is one of these things I saw pop up on my screen that said you just got a job as a prison chaplain, and I said, wow, that is really something, because, you know, most kids, when they grow up, they say, well, I want to be an astronaut or a rock star or president of the United States or something like that. But I can't remember anybody wanting to say, well, I think I want to be a prison chaplain. And so I want to kind of figure out, how does somebody get there, and what kind of stuff they do. So that's kind of what we're going to do here. Why don't we just go ahead and go back to your childhood? Did you want to be a prison chaplain since you were?
No, I want to be as far away from a prison as I possibly could be.
Well, that's probably a good idea.
I was with a lot of kids who ended up going into prison. So
tell us a little bit about your childhood. You mentioned you were in foster care. Did you have a religious upbringing? What was the childhood like?
No, I didn't really have a religious upbringing. My parents were different kinds of cats. I was born in 67, just before the Summer of Love. So, you're kind of familiar with the cultural stuff that was going on at that period.
Oh, yeah.
My mom would have called herself kind of a hippie at the time. My dad was more like a beatnik. And they were both Vietnam War protesters and kind of involved in that, protest this and that kind of. I call them cause the month crowd now. They would be upset at hearing me say that. that's kind of how I viewed that. It ended up later on. I was in Santa Cruz in one of the in a couple of the group homes that I lived in, and it was very steeped in, even in the mid '80s. It was still very late 1960s-ish. All right, so I got a very close look at how the culture they might have been in the late 60s in the state college kind of thing. But I think probably the best way to describe the journey is a story that I use when I'm teaching about the importance of family. There was a child who was born to his mother and father, and lived in a household where there's a lot of arguing and a lot of tension and that sort of thing. And his parents split up, and he was about 4 years old. And this kid went with his mom, and his mom didn't handle motherhood very well. And so he was back and forth between his mom, his grandparents, and foster care. There was a hearing court hearing in Colorado to decide who would get custody when his parents divorced. And mom didn't even show up. His dad was there, and his grandparents were there. The grandparents got custody. The dad said, well, hey, you know, I've talked over with the boy here. We'd really like to have about a half hour for lunch before we all go our separate ways. They spent about 15 minutes, and they jetted out to California. So you've got the mom in Colorado, you got the grandparents in New Mexico, and the dad out in California. He was there about 2 weeks before the dad started just really being abusive. At one point, he showed up to school one day and had bruises all over his hands, all over the middle of his back, and all over the backs of his hamstrings and stuff. The courts took him away, and he ended up being in group homes from the time he was 9 years old to the time he graduated high school. It was interesting because the parents, the grandparents and the mom knew where he was that whole time. But there was kind of a possession is 9/10 of the law kind of thing between the three states at that point, where because the father actually had him there, he was a natural father, it would have taken the mother to go pick him up. They could have picked him up right out of school, but grandparents and aunt and uncle and everybody was, well, let's go get him. And the mom said, well, we can, but I need you to give me some money first. So it was kind of a real strange kind of situation. But after he got out of, after he graduated high school, he went into the military. And kind of grew a bit, but it was more after he got out that he was really doing the growing. But he got out and went back to Santa Cruz, which is the last, was where he, you know, gone through school and all that, graduated high school. And he met at a swimming pool party a guy by the name of Tommy Thompson. And Tommy Thompson kind of took him under his wing and taught him and spent a pretty good deal of time studying the Bible with him, something that very few people had actually taken the time to do, studying with him in detail. But on July 31st, 1989, Tommy Thompson killed that young man in baptism. When I came out of the water, I understood that I had a family that was so big that I couldn't meet every individual member of that family if I set out and tried to do it right now. That's my story.
Yeah, that is a really interesting story. And it's interesting how you tell it in the third person, but then after baptism, you take ownership of the story then again.
Yes, sir. Yes. Well, I mean, that is the new birth. I talk about that person in the third person because, yeah, that's my heritage. And I have my eyes, my glasses are ground to the vision because of what I went through as a child, but that's still really not me. I'm a new person in Christ. I'm a totally, completely different person in Christ because I've been watching the blood.
Let me ask about this older guy here. You mentioned that he went into the military and did some growing up at that point in time. Did the military have any type of change in terms of worldview that might have softened you up for a conversion, or at some point did, you know, you see things differently in the military?
There were things that happened while I was in there that kind of did soften me up. But I think the major problem that I had was that, see, I'm hard-headed by nature, and I have an attitude problem, and I've got an anger problem, all right? And a lot of it had to do with the fact that, you know, my parents really wanted to stick it to the man. You know, it was that kind of, up with the establishment kind of crap that they fed me with. And so when I was in the military, I had a real problem with authority. And I'm sure you can understand that being in the Marine Corps and having a problem with authority is a problem.
That's going to be a problem, yeah. Unless you're a general, and I assume you weren't a general.
No.
Yeah, so unless you're a general, yeah, you got to kind of do the whole authority thing.
Yeah, and really, I did most of my learning about dealing with authority and just not having an attitude. Looking back on the stupid crap that I pulled when I was in the book, how stupid some of that stuff really, really was. Why did I do that? Why? How could I be so dumb? Anyway, the growth really happened after I got out. But there was one point when I was in that because I was having such an attitude problem at the time, I flipped out, and I ended up stabbing my wall locker 72 times.
Wow.
with a big old knife, all right? And it was that time they sent me to the chaplain to see if they could straighten Hennig out. And really, of course, there's two sides to everything, maybe three sides, depending on who you talk to. But I mean, that got straightened out, but that was really the start of that. That was that rock bottom moment when I really started my search, coming from New Age and going into Christianity. I had a number of people that kind of, took a closer look at me and said, hey, we need to teach this guy.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned you were associated with the New Age movement, and was this during the military, prior to the military, after the military? When's all this happening?
It was, a little bit prior to, and mostly during. I had, like a lot of people that got into the New Age movement, I had gotten into playing role-playing games, Dungeons and Dragons and that sort of thing, and for me, when I was in the Corps, the Dungeons and Dragons role-playing stuff was kind of an extension of the sand table. You always learn strategy stuff, because I was an anti-tank gunner, all right? Mm-hmm. I was a TOW 2 gunner, and we would get out there, and we'd move the tanks around on the board, and we would say, well, okay, we've got to move our troops over this way, and, you know, the grand scheme of things, calling for indirect fire and all that sort of thing. Well, the thing that we would do with the role-playing game is, okay, what would you actually do if a situation comes up like this, right? We're so used to doing it on the sand table with tanks and the troops out in the open and all that stuff that it was a natural extension of that down to, okay, you don't really get a whole lot of training on what you would do at the individual fire team level, the individual squad level. So we did a lot of that in the role-playing game. And a lot of, imagination. Well, as a part of that, I started really getting interested in kind of the dark arts side of it, the earth magic side of it, and stuff like that. So I started going in that direction. And I think that was also a big part of my my descent, so to speak, into rock bottom.
And so you come out of the military, and it's a rough go with your problems with authority and things like this. You meet this Tommy guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
How is this going? I mean, I'm kind of interested in seeing the process here. You met a chaplain in the military, and then there's this Tommy guy. Did the guy first come up and say, hey, you need Christ, here's a Bible, we're going to turn your life? Or was this an ongoing process? Did it take a lot of time?
It took a couple of years, actually. I actually got out of the military in 89, and it was in May. Oh, I can't remember what my EAS was, but it was toward the middle of May, I think. It was after I met this chaplain, I started that search. I started visiting different churches and stuff and where I wanted to go. And, I even had on my dog tag, you had a choice. You could be Catholic, Protestant, Baptist, whatever. I just said, man, I just want to be a Christian. Do I have to choose a title? And so they let me put Christian on my dog tag. They didn't, have to put a denomination or anything like that on it. Well, I got out and I went to this swimming pool party with a friend of mine that I had taken to the senior prom. And she was getting ready to get married, but they were having a swimming pool, like a one last swimming pool party at her house, or her parents' house, before she went off to get married. And they had a bunch of members of the church there. And we recognized we had a number of things in common, choices in music and that sort of thing. And then they started sharing Christ with me. And this period of study See, this, Tommy Thompson's an interesting cat. He would sell insurance. That's how he supported his family. But his primary goal was one-on-one Bible study. And so we had a one-on-one Bible study that lasted about a month. And the thing was, I learned as much from his wife as I did from him, because she had taken the same classes, same Bible classes. So she knew all the Greek and all the Hebrew that he had studied, right? And so at the end of about that month, that was when, he taught me about the importance of baptism and all these different things. And so it was at the end of that month, about at midnight, if I remember right, on July 31st of 89, that we actually went down to the church building and hit that baptistry. And I guess you could say we had another swimming pool party.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I'm sure this stuff is going to really fill in your experience being a prison chaplain as well. I mean, this is something you understand. It's a long-term process, and it's step-by-step. It's not something that just strikes you by lightning out of the blue. And so this is one of the reasons I'm interested in your background here, because a lot of people, their background really informs who they are today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it does make a lot of connections in the prison. It absolutely does. Because a lot of guys that you meet in the prison, I mean, you get a lot of guys that had, your preacher's kids that had the perfect homes and all that, and they just rebelled against that, right? There's that set of guys. But then there's the other set of guys that, it's not your, it's not your Norman Rockwell painting of a home life. A lot of guys that did come out of foster care and group homes, or only had one mom and no dad, or had a dad and no mom, or however that worked out, raised by their grandparents, and there's a lot of commonality there. And a lot of them, when they find this out about me, will look at me as one of them and not a guy wearing a uniform.
Yeah. That I can kind of see. One of the questions, I want to get to your prison ministry experience here in a moment, but I'm also curious what other jobs you did. You got out of the military in 89, but it's not for maybe another 7, 8, 9, 10 years before you actually start working in prison ministry. What are you doing then?
I left Santa Cruz in 1992. And that was to go sing with an a cappella singing group. But in between getting out of the military and doing that, my first job was with a group home agency, and I was working as a counselor and all that. I wasn't mature enough at that point. I hadn't really grown from my experiences yet, and I wasn't ready for that. And so that job didn't last long. And I did a lot of retail after that. I pretty much bounced from job to job at that point.
Yeah, so you're selling stuff. But you mentioned that you're in an a cappella group, right? And this is kind of one of these interesting things that blows away a lot of stereotypes, right? You're a Marine Corps grunt, an anti-tank gunner, rough and tumble life in group homes and that kind of thing. And you're singing a cappella. I mean, a cappella are the guys that wear those white seersucker suits and are so,
Right.
So what's with the a cappella stuff?
Well, there's a cappella and then there's a cappella, if I could put it that way. But, When I was in the Corps, I used to jam a lot with a guy who was just a ridiculously gifted guitarist, all right? And I would sing all my, we would do all our favorite, Led Zeppelin stuff and AC/DC and some Beatles stuff and all like that. He would be playing just beautifully, and I would absolutely murder these songs. I mean, I was just destroying these songs. Now, I talked to him later because we met back up again on Facebook. He said, "Oh, no, your pitch was on and all that." But, dude, I was falsetto screaming the whole Led Zeppelin catalog. Come on. When I got out and got involved with this congregation, well, the thing is, this church that I got involved with, it's the Church of Christ, and they don't use musical instruments in worship, right? And so my whole life of trying to think I could sing and then realize, no, you sound like crap, Jeff. I realized there was this thing called four-part harmony, and there was soprano, alto, tenor, bass. And I'm supposed to be singing down here with these guys that sing bass. I'm not supposed to be a tenor or an alto or whatever else. I'm supposed to be singing bass. That's how God designed it, all right? So I learned that. Then they had a cappella groups coming through all the time. And I found out, oh, wait, I can stick with these guys that sing rhythm bass. You know, and it's not your, the groups that were coming through were not your barbershop quartet. They might have a chorus come through or something like that. But it is more like, if you've ever heard of Rockapella or Take Six, or now the major group is Pentatonix. Mm-hmm. All right. There's a, groups like that would come through. And I find out, well, I can sing exactly what these basses are singing and then some. Hey, maybe I should try that. So, one of the groups that had come through came out to was based out of Arkansas, and it turned out, well, they needed a bass. So I tried out, and they asked me to come out, and I started singing with them. And that's when I left California. It was in January of 92.
And we're already moving toward Arkansas here, which is where you're ended up now. And this connection as well brings you into the realm of prison ministry. So explain that.
Well, I don't know how much you know about music industry stuff, but especially a cappella groups. A cappella groups have a real high turnover for the most part, personnel-wise, because a lot of them are going to be your college kids, and they cycle through, and they have their fun times with their summer tours and stuff like that, and then time to go out and get a real job, right? So I went through a couple of different singing. In fact, I think it was, I went through about three different singing groups in that short period of time. And in 93, I left and went to go study at Freed Hardeman, which is in West Tennessee. And I graduated there and met the woman I would marry while in school. And we stayed in West Tennessee. Well, she ended up leaving me. And there's a story involved there, too. And I had friends in Alabama. So I left West Tennessee and went to Alabama. And I sang with, I had sung with choruses and stuff when I was at Freed Hardeman. Choruses, small ensemble. But when I went to Alabama, northern Alabama, I was out of Huntsville. There's a church there, Southside Church of Christ out of Rogersville. And it's pretty, it's black congregation. I was the only white guy there. I lovingly tell them I was the only nut in that fudge bar. and they took me in as family.
Mm-hmm.
They took me in as family. They still accept me as family there. And so I sang with a chorus there, and then one of the guys that I used to sing with and I, we've been co-writers for a while, written songs together a lot, and we put together a recording project. And then there were two other guys that we decided we wanted to try singing with. Both of them were out of Searcy, Arkansas. Well, one of the guys that was in Searcy had been, he'd been incarcerated himself out of Texas a few years prior to that. And so when we got together, we decided, hey, let's just make this a prison mission singing group. Let's make this the focus of this. So we sang at numerous prisons all over Arkansas. And that was my first step into prison ministry.
That's kind of interesting, because I guess there's that Johnny Cash story, too, where he goes to Folsom Prison and sings and all of that. You asked me if I knew anything about the music industry a little bit, but I didn't know that there were a lot of a cappella groups that were.
Yeah. It's very, very under the radar. A cappella, you know, if you watch the Sing Off or something like that, that's kind of a niche market, right? But especially if you're talking with people who are in the Churches of Christ or maybe Disciples of Christ or something, or if you hit the college campus across the country, a cappella is huge in the college campus.
Probably not here at the University of Washington. I don't, I 21 years there and I still haven't heard a cappella, but it gets you into the prisons and it gets you into doing prison ministry. So what does it mean to do a cappella prison ministry? Are you singing like, you know, accept Christ and don't commit more crimes or something? What are you doing?
Just singing. singing the same stuff that we sung on the outside. But there is something about the human voice in harmony that can really grip the heart. There's something we say that that the human voice is the only instrument made by God. And there's something to that. I don't want to be judgmental and say, well, that's the only way you can reach it. No, that's not what I'm saying at all. But there is something special about the human voice, most definitely. And I've always said, you know, I love, there's nothing more erotic than the sound of a bent guitar string. There's nothing more moving to me than the human voice. And I think in doing that, I mean, people are reached in different ways, obviously. You know, there are people that come into the chapel that are using tracks, pre-recorded tracks to sing with. There are guys that come in there with guys and women coming in there with guitars, mandolin, piano, whatever, you know. But there's something that really captures the attention, captures the imagination, and captures the heart when it's nothing but the human voice that I've really, really paid close attention to.
So you have this gift, and you're using the voice, and it gets you into prison, and you know, people are going to say, okay, what are we going to do today? There's these guys, they're coming and singing, that's fine. But it's a prison ministry, so is this... Actually, tell me about the first time that you did this and that you walked into the prison. Was there were you nervous? Was this, I don't know if I should be doing this, or did it just feel natural?
It felt natural, and the reason I say that is I had had enough tough experiences in my life that hearing a door slam shut behind me wasn't going to do it. I had prepared myself mentally for it. I prepared myself mentally for boot camp. I knew that these guys were going to be shouting at me a lot. I knew that these guys were, these drill instructors were going to call me all kinds of foul and nasty names, and they're going to call me everything but the son of God, you know. And I knew it was going to be a physical experience too, but I was a high school athlete. I wasn't worried about that. I was worried about the mind game, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got there and they were cartoon characters, they really, really were. These drill instructors were cartoon. And the hardest thing for me in boot camp was to not laugh. I was always in trouble for laughing. When they would say something that was meant to tear me up and I'm laughing, I can't help it because it's freaking funny. These guys have a sense of humor that won't stop. I mean, one of the things is, okay, in the military, in the Marine Corps, they use a lot of Navy jargon, right? So the bathroom is the head. What we're sitting at the quarterdeck, it was the front of the squad bay, and we're in a class, and we hadn't gone to the bathroom in a long time. And one of the guys really, really had to go. He said, "Sir, private request permission to make emergency head call, sir." He said, "Oh, it's an emergency. I don't hear a siren." A siren? Yeah, it's a siren. No, a siren. Oh, my goodness. So anyway, so I'm prepared for all this. I'm prepared for the prison being this really austere environment and stuff. And when I was preparing for it like that, and then to walk in there, and it wasn't so bad.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, it was kind of uplifting in that. You know, and then when you're used to doing it every day, another door shut.
Yeah, well, what was it like to do that? You come in, you do some songs, do you get to talk with the guys? Are the guys who are there, were they forced to be there, or was this all, hey, I'll come out of my own free volition? What did a typical day look like?
Oh, it was advertised within the barracks. They put up a little flyer in the barracks, and whoever wanted to come out would come out. We didn't go, like, say, from barracks to barracks. We just came out to the chapel. And that's how it would be, because you have, the way it was set up, the contemporary acapella that I've been accustomed to, you have your standard voicings and stuff, but then the rhythm bass, you have to have it amplified if you're going to hear it at all, because the stuff that I'm singing is typically down where your standard tuned four-string bass guitar plays, and sometimes even a little bit lower. And so in order to hear that, it has to be amplified. I mean, you'll feel it, but you won't hear it until it's amplified. So in order to do that, you have to have all the PA gears, all the mics and equipment and everything all in one place. So you can't really do that from barracks to barracks. Now, we did do it once without amplification in the county jail, at the White County Jail, and we were actually singing down the hallway.
Hmm.
We had to rearrange it a little bit, but we were able to get away with it because, I mean, you know, we don't have to read music all. We can arrange stuff on the fly. But so that worked out. But to do the way we normally do it, you really do need gear to be able to pull that off. So,
okay, so you're rolling with your gear. You're doing some songs. You get to talk one-on-one with any of the guys?
A little bit. You know, just after the concert was over, we would, of course, say stuff in between songs, like in any concert, but then we were done, and there's usually not a whole lot of time because they don't want the inmates kind of their own free volition kind of milling about stuff, and that's when trouble happens. Mm-hmm. They kind of want to get them out of there in a hurry.
Okay.
So it takes about 15 minutes to get them all out of there. But in that 15 minutes, we're able to have some really good conversations, you know, and they were able to get across some stuff. There was some back and forth there, so it was really good.
So, these are, I guess, our 15-minute sermons that you get to give, or conversations, and you said you do, you know, a little bit of talking between songs. Are you talking about religious stuff? Are you talking about turning your life around, maybe telling your own life story? What are you saying to these guys?
That's absolutely right. It's we are, since the time is limited, we're getting into stuff that really matters. We're trying not to do a whole lot of small talk, although that does happen. Hey, how you doing? You know, but time is of the essence at that point, and you really want to have the meatier conversation. So that was a lot of what happened.
Now, did you get any religious training or ministry training before you went in there, or is this all on the fly? Just say, hey, we're going to sing, we're going to talk about God, or did somebody say, okay, this is what it's going to be like prison ministering, these are the themes you should talk about, blah, blah, blah?
We had all gone to school at religious-oriented schools. Like I said, I'm a pre-Harlan University graduate, and that's a Bible school, first and foremost. And there were a couple of us that had gone that route. There were a couple of us that had gone to Harding, which is another school. Like, it's kind of a brotherhood school, their sisterhood school to pre-Harlan. And there's one that's actually a missionary son. Oh, he's gotten it right from the beginning.
Yep.
In fact, all the rest of them were graduates of Harding Academy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had all had it all the way from, you know, grade school on up, and I was the only oddball that started late at 23 years old, you know. But we had all had religious training quite extensively. And so it was, you know, it was easy to talk about that sort of thing. And get into that without having to really brush up or anything.
Yeah, but you have religious training. I mean, there's religious training where you sit down and you say, we're going to really dig into the book of Luke today, and that's going to be our semester. And then there's religious training, like, okay, now you're out there doing the missions and you're in a prison. I doubt you had a course on how to sing at prison missions thing. how well did that training at your university prepare you for what you were going to do in the prison?
Well, it's like this. The training that we got in school was your foundation, all right? And I'm going to liken it to Marine Corps training, rifle marksmanship, all right? When you go out and you're in Marine Corps boot camp, you learn the basics of rifle marksmanship, and you sight in on that barrel that has all those targets on it. And then you go out to the rifle range and you sight in and you get your known distance range, and you're firing it, 200 yards, 300 yards, and 500. And then you go on all of your, training missions and stuff. You're going through the crucible. You're going through all of this stuff. Okay, so you've got the basics. Okay, now when you get out to the fleet, that's when your training really starts. That's when the real life stuff is actually going on and you're learning on the job. But you've got the foundation back here, right? It was like that doing this. This is actual live fire mission here. This is actual, you know, the bullets are flying right here. We've got all the basics from all the book knowledge and all that, and even missionary training type stuff. This is where it's put into practice. And if you If you studied really hard and allowed that stuff to really seep in, well, then you've got ready answers for stuff. So, no, you're not prepared, but yeah, you are.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of answer I can give to that.
Yeah, and you did this ministry, this singing ministry, I guess, for about 10 years. Is that correct?
Actually, I have been involved in different singing ministries since 92, off and on.
Okay.
So really, now the one group, yeah, that group lasted just a couple of years, like a couple of groups typically do. I'm singing with one now that isn't doing prison ministry. It's just, I mean, with different churches and functions and stuff, haven't really done prison ministry with this group. So I have been with this particular group. Now, this one has been 10 years.
Okay.
The one that I'm with now, a group called First Day.
Okay, so that's where I might be confusing this with, but I'm interested in your time doing the prison ministry, and mm-hmm. What are you learning over the course? So you started, I guess, back in 92, so you've been doing this since almost more than two decades now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so what are you learning, right? You had your foundation at the university, then you go, quote-unquote, into live fire. What were some of the things that you learned over time that you did better, that you maybe gave up on some of this stuff and then emphasized more of that stuff?
Well, one of the things was that it was kind of instinctive, but that I learned, it kind of got more ingrained in me later was, first I stopped reading the local newspaper. And it took a while, but I stopped. I used to be a news junkie, okay? Just, I mean, anything I could get my hands on, whether it was radio talk show, whether it was, news on TV, news on the internet, whatever. And what I found is, for a number of reasons, I can't do that anymore. And one of the reasons is that whatever these guys did to get into jail or get into prison for, it's going to be all over the news. I don't need to have that informing how I talk to them. You know, I don't need to know that this guy was a child molester or a serial killer or whatever the flip it was. This guy is wearing a prison uniform and he needs Jesus. And I need to talk to him just like I would talk to my buddies off the street. Informed by the fact that we're in the prison environment, but I don't need to know specifically what he did that got him there. Now, he may volunteer that. I'm not asking. In fact, I'm probably going to tell him, I don't want to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just talk as people here. You are what you did, you know? And so that was one of the things that really had to, like I said, it was instinctive at first, but then the value of that grew on later. So, but yeah, that was,
How did the inmates react to you? I mean, I'm kind of thinking this is interesting. They're coming to see some people sing. I'm sure some of them are just kind of curious. It's something to do. It's anything to do. But other people might be a little bit more intrigued that, oh, these guys will be talking a little bit about Jesus. Maybe I want to hear some about that. So what were the general reactions?
Well, remember what we were talking about at the beginning of this interview about some children want to grow up to be rock stars?
Mm-hmm.
It was very much like that.
Mm.
If you want to have a life affirmation moment and you are a musician or even just a speaker on, you know, whatever topic, the best place you can do that is at a prison because they're hungry for people to come in from the outside. All they see all day are people wearing white, you know, the prison uniforms, or they see people wearing blue, which is the officers. The suits are always going to be wardens or somebody that they really don't want to see. And the only break they get from that is when a free world person comes in from the outside and actually takes time to spend time with them. They find that as being incredibly valuable. So they're very enthusiastic. In fact, we sang in a women's prison once that is for a Christmas program. And you'd have thought we were the Beatles.
Hmm.
Seriously, you would have thought we were the Beatles. They were screaming, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
And so you, as you mentioned, you don't get a whole lot of time to talk to these folks. Do you ever get any chance to do during this period of time? And this is before you become an official prison chaplain paid by the state. But do you ever get the opportunity to meet with any of these guys one on one?
You mean like while we were in the singing group and doing all that?
Yeah.
Not a lot other than the after show.
Okay.
Kind of thing. After service kind of thing.
So Mike, the question I'm leading with here is then, were there any things that they wanted to talk about? I mean, you guys are coming in from the outside, you're singing, that's kind of neat. You know, you're dropping a religious message here and there in between the singing or a little bit afterwards. And are there any themes that come up that people want to say, hey, I want to know how to turn my life around, or you guys are just a crock and you don't know anything about us? Wait, anything come up in general?
All the above. All the above. I mean, you know, it's always very varied, but a lot of the same stuff came up from them that normally comes up after the standard. Oh man, you guys are great, or you guys were okay, you know, whatever, the technical stuff. But it was a lot of gratitude. Thank you for coming in from out there to see us in here. Thank you for coming in and sharing your time with us. And there were some specific religious questions, but it was mostly in that kind of vein of thought.
And I can just see that as being such an open door that a lot of these guys probably said, okay, yeah, I made a bunch of errors. I did a lot of dumb things. People are going to forget about me, just like, you know, throwing a trash out or something. But then somebody comes in and says, hey, you know, I could be doing something else, going to the movies tonight or out to the beach. But yeah, you guys showed up for us, and that's pretty cool. I can imagine that's a huge opening.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a huge opening. And again, more than anything else, it was, you know, their gratitude and, you know, and their, and the uplifting moment that, kind of helped power them through some stuff. Now, there's an upside and a downside of that. Something I found out in the jail was that, oftentimes some of the worst nights were on a church night as far as dealing with guys acting up in the cell, or guys acting up in the pod, because you know when you have that mountaintop moment,
mm-hmm.
that valley isn't very far.
Yeah,
it's very easy to step off into that valley, and a lot of these guys would go that way. And so, man, they're all excited. Man, this is it. And the slightest little thing sets them off, and next thing you know, there's a big fight over, you know, somebody got more green beans on his plate than I did. You know, that kind of garbage. But then, also, there's a flip side to it that the night goes much more peacefully. You know, and I don't know, I couldn't give you the percentages, all right, but I would say that it's more often that it goes more peacefully afterwards, but, you know, it's maybe 60-40.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah. So, throughout this time, you're meeting these folks, and I'm sure you go back to some of the same prisons time and time again, right? Did you ever have a moment where somebody says, yeah, I've seen you a couple times, and it's really changed my life, or maybe even on the outside, they get paroled, or they finish their time, and they come out, and they see you somewhere, and they say, man, you were really an influence. Did that experience ever happen?
Not much, and this is why. That group, the group that did the prison work was known as Jonah.
Mm-hmm.
And that group didn't last really, really long. It only lasted a couple of years. And so we didn't really, I think we only did, there was only one prison that we did twice. Well, no, I take that back. When we went to the women's prison, we did go there pretty much every year.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing with that was, we went, it was something like, I want to say it was 8 years, maybe 9 years of doing that Christmas program every year. And the problem with that was, okay, the first couple of years it was Jonah. And then it was, okay, what group can we throw together this year?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was doing it every year. In fact, there was a couple of us that was every year. But the only person they recognized after a while was me. So it was different every year after that.
Mm-hmm. I want to move into your current job right now, is that as a prison chaplain. This is what piqued my interest on Facebook when you announced, hey, I got a new job. This was, I guess, about 4 or 5 months ago?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it was January 20th, actually.
Okay. So just a few months ago. How did you get picked up into that job?
I had been working as a jail chaplain for about 9 years. I want to say it was from 05 until, I don't know, I think it was August of 05 until, like I said, January.
And you said jail chaplain here. Now, that's different than prison. I think people don't typically know the difference between prison and jail, but give us a little difference.
Oh, yeah, there's a big difference. Yeah. There's a big difference. And let me go into that for just a minute, because it is actually a pretty stark difference. The county jail is usually the first place you go when you get busted, all right, for whatever you do. And it's a very transient population. And you go in there, and you could be in there overnight till you get your, till you get bonded out. You could be there up to a year. The longest I've ever seen anybody in there was, I want to say it was 10 months. All right, but it could be up to a year. And so there's that uncertainty there. There's that unrest there. It's a pretty young population compared with the prison. Because most of the time, unless you've committed murder or something, unless you've committed something really serious, usually what happens is you start out with minor offenses and you build up to bigger offenses. The minor offenses are kind of a gateway drug to the major offense, so to speak. And the prison environment is much more stable. Most of the guys, okay, they know they're settled in for a while. And it's an older population, because most of the guys, they already did their small offenses. Now they're away for a while. They're in the prison for a while. They're going to be there. And as a result, there's a different mindset between the jail and the prison. In the jail, there's a lot of turmoil, a lot of upheaval, a lot of drama, because guys just don't know. The not knowing is what's killing people, right? And so they're trying to get all their ducks in a row, trying to get everything straightened out so that they can beat the court thing, or so they can get a better prison assignment or whatever it is. And you'll see guys get baptized multiple times. It's horrible. I knew one guy that I had been working there 5 years, and he'd been baptized 7 or 8 times. You tell these that, well, you get baptized once, you get dunked all the rest of the time. But it doesn't, you know, I want that reset button. You know, then you go to the prison, and guys are much more studious about things. They'll take their time a little bit more before they jump into something. It's much more of an adult kind of thing, much more settled.
And so did you find it pretty difficult dealing with a lot of these guys who are in and out and the more turbulent upheaval in the jail when you're doing your ministering? Was there specific challenges that you faced with these guys?
Very ADD, just in general. Very the ability to concentrate. I mean, their attention has been docked, okay, no question. But you know as well as I do that one person's rock bottom is not somebody else's rock bottom. You know, it doesn't take me going to jail for me to hit rock bottom. A lot of these guys, they could be in prison for 6-7 years. That's not even rock bottom for them. So everybody's different, but. That said, that jail environment is very iffy because there's different things showing up to take somebody's attention at any given moment. And because things are so unsettled, you also have attitudes that are very unsettled. Things are more amped up. It's almost like you've got a gladiator school kind of environment there as compared with you get to the prison, most guys are just trying to do their time.
How successful were you in that environment? Now, actually, we were talking about the a cappella group that you did before, but as a jail chaplain, And was this a paid position, or were you volunteering? What was that?
Yes.
You both?
Depending on what time period we're talking about. When I first started, it was an hourly thing. I just worked for the church. Right? It wasn't a county paid position. The county had actually invited the church to come in and run their chaplaincy program, run their Bible program. And so they did. So we did. And it had been going a long time before I got involved in it. When I first started, it was an hourly wage paid by the church just as an employee.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I transitioned to including my work at the prison, I was a certified religious assistant volunteer at one of the prison units nearby. I transitioned from being a jail chaplain to, I called myself a prison missionary. Because it was easier to describe it that way. It made more sense to describe it that way because I was working in both. And now that was really interesting because a lot of the guys that I knew from county, I'd meet up with them in the prison. And I'm still doing that at the prison I work with further south. And that was a blessing because that was able to get a lot of conversations going.
Mm-hmm.
And you got somebody in the cell block or somebody in the barracks who recognizes you from when they were at county, there's a lot of legitimacy that opens up there. And so guys are more free to talk. They feel more free to talk. But as far as, I think I went pretty far afield on that. I don't remember where we started.
Well, it leads me to another question about when you see these guys in there, whether it's at the jail or in prison, Are they coming up to you? Are you coming up to them? Are there certain people that you can tell are just primed and they're ready? They've hit perhaps their rock bottom. They're willing to make some turnarounds. I mean, how do you get a sense of this?
The nature of what's going on in the prison right now is that, and I'm sure we'll get into dealing with legal issues and stuff like that in a little bit. We talked about that, but there is a Supreme Court case decision that was just passed recently about the constitutionality of religious facial hair growth. All right, it is considered to be an expression of your faith to be able to grow a beard, to be able to grow your hair, that sort of thing, right? And we're going through the process of doing this religious approval thing, and without going into specific details, let's just say that there's a whole bunch of guys who really want to talk to me right now specifically about that, and trying to weed those guys out from the guys that really want to talk about important stuff, that's become a major job in and of itself. And so it's not so much our guys coming up and talking. Oh, yeah, constantly. Guys are beating down the door to come out to the chapel.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that 80% of the time, it's these guys that are, they just want a phone call, and the only way they know to get it, even though you're only supposed to get a phone call if it's a family emergency, they'll game to get it. They'll play games to get it. Or they're wanting to find out the status of their beard request or something like that. And finding guys that really actually honestly want to talk, that's a tough process. That's a really tough process. I'm learning that. Again, I'm new to this game, but I'm learning that. But it's still, I mean, even for guys that have been doing this forever, our senior chaplain has been doing it 30 years, and he has a hard time with it. Because guys, they're in the prison, they got time. They got time to hone their craft at gameplay. You know, so that's a major problem right there.
Are there any themes that come up with some of these folks that are really sincere about making their life turn around? I mean, do you see, start talking about redemption, wanting to really kind of pay back what they've done or anything like that?
Oh, there's a lot of that. All of that and more. A real common thread with them is, obviously is freedom. Dealing with being in bondage and all that goes with that. And how do I make it so I don't have to come back here? And if they are here, and they're here for the long haul, what do I do to make this bearable? And what do I do to, you know, what do I do to make things right that I made so very, very wrong? What can I do to help my family who's now without a father, a grandfather, a son, whatever? What can I do to make it easier for them now that we're in this spot? Those are the kind of questions.
Let me ask this too, because I've asked this of pastors and others before. I actually think being a minister is one of the toughest jobs out there, because you carry not only, you know, the burdens of, you know, your own journey through life, but you have to carry the burdens of many other people, and that can be a very trying time. In fact, you know, most people tend to seek out their pastor not when things are going great and say, hey, we want to celebrate all these wonderful things and stuff, but oftentimes when things are pretty dark and seedy. And how do you manage that? I mean, for me, that just, I mean, I'm in awe of people who can really do that.
Well, it varies from time to time, and I'm in awe of people who can do that too. You know, it is tough. There are times it takes knowing when to put up certain walls, put up certain boundaries. And that is that's a balancing act. It's a major balancing act, because, and this is something that I have been struggling with. See, I'm pretty much an empath. It's very easy for me to feel someone else's feelings, because I'm very sensitive to feeling other people's feelings. By osmosis, almost. You know, the musician's ear is very sensitive to musical things, to sound-related things. The painter or the photographer's eye is very sensitive to light. And I feel like almost a figure in the Fall of the House of Ushers with all of my senses in empathy. It's very easy for me to pick up those kind of emotional things. And so in order for me to not be overwhelmed, I have to put walls up every now and then, especially if somebody's real, you know, death notices, or somebody has a family member who's in the hospital who they may not make it through the night. I have to put up a wall right there. Otherwise, I will be in a puddle in the floor next to them. And I won't be able to do for them what they need to have done for them. Now, a little bit of lowering the wall is okay, because they need to see that somebody is feeling this with them. Okay? So I do that. But too much of that, and I've got to go. There's no question. I have got to go. And oftentimes I'll finish in there and I'll go back to my office and I'll say, okay, I'm unplugging the phone. I'm going to go hide away in the office for a little bit. I'm going to go in my closet and pray, do whatever I got to do. And then I'll come out again in maybe a half hour or something. Have to do it. You know, that's Jesus' example. When he fed the 5,000, what did he do? He went up to the mountain and prayed.
Yeah.
Got to do it.
I can imagine that. You know, it is such a hard burden. You mentioned keeping, you know, a wall up to do for somebody what they need to have done for them. What do you mean by that they have to have done for them? Just a firm guidance that leads them through a very tough moment, or what?
Yeah, they need to hear what needs to be said.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to say that I'm the supreme arbiter of what. You know, no, I'm not. You know, I'm not Chuck Heston leading the Israelites out of Egypt. You know, I'm not that guy. But I do know, just from my own experience and from what I've read from God's experience, that there are certain things that need to happen. You got to process your grief, for one. You can't hold on to that and expect to heal. All right, you've got to feel this stuff. You know, the addict has a lot of times stopped emotional development at whatever age they became an addict, because, say, they were drinking to drown out their sorrow or whatever. Well, it's one thing to do it once, but that becomes your habit. That becomes your way of dealing with it. Well, the time that you started doing that as a habit, say, was, you know, 15 years old or whatever, your emotional age does not progress past that 15, 16 years old because you stop dealing with your grief. You stop dealing with your problems rationally. You just drank them away, right? So that's one thing that has to happen right at that moment. You got to deal with your grief. And, of course, everybody deals with it differently, right? But if you don't deal with it and deal with it now, you just try and stuff it, you forget it. You know, you're going to end up having major issues later and probably, you know, blow up and get disciplinaries and everything else. Aside from the damage that you're doing to your own heart, you're going to put yourself in a harder place. So, you know, I'm trying to encourage them to do that sort of thing. But, what you know, of course, I'm not being stupid. You know, I know how you feel, you know, all that poppycock. That doesn't work, you know. But giving them the things that they need to process this stuff. Because it's really hard. And if you're in a spot like, and a lot of these guys, they don't have these life skills. That's why they're in prison. You know, a lot of guys will explode and they'll go out and punch somebody in the face because they can't handle their emotions. They can't handle the fact that, that mom or dad, doesn't want them in the house anymore. They can't handle the fact that they had a family member pass away or whatever. So what do? They go out and beat somebody up. Or they goad somebody else and beat them up. However, you know, whatever they end up doing isn't healthy. And so what I'm trying to provide for them is a way that they can come down, in a healthy way. It doesn't always work, obviously, but that's the process. And in order for me to be able to provide that to them, I have to be thinking clearly. If I don't have my walls up, it's kind of like, you know, the doctor is a stupid person who tries to care for his own family. It's the same principle. You get too emotionally involved, then you can make some really bad decisions. But yet you have to remain empathetic in order to be able to understand their emotional state and to be able to actually provide the healing, help with the healing process.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever get the opportunity to meet with some of these guys when they're on the outside? I mean, I know the prison ministry, you're helping them through some really difficult times on the inside, so to speak. But, you know, one of the things that we talked to with Byron Johnson about this, who studies this from an academic angle, there's the aftercare. There's, you know, once you get out into the real world, you're in a much different environment. You're not in that regulated, enclosed environment. Is part of the prison chaplain's responsibility to really minister to some of these guys on the outside, or how does that work?
There has been a little bit of an imposition on that, that we're supposed to hand those off to other people. And that's a tough line because I want to be able to help in the continuation of that care, the continuation of that process and everything. But there's also the main problem is dealing with security. They don't want somebody to have a relationship with somebody outside the prison walls like that, because they're afraid that, well, too many employees have been turned by ex-cons and they end up smuggling stuff in, blah, 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 all that stuff, right? So they're very leery of that. But in as far as how I personally deal with it, I run into people that, you know, Walmart or a restaurant or whatever it is out in town. And a lot of guys are going to be ashamed of where they know me from, you know, prison or jail or whatever. So what I typically do, is I'll see them, but I won't say anything, and I'll allow them to say something to me. As soon as they say something to me, oh, hey, how you doing? You know, and we can continue the conversation that way, without worrying about, you know, his own personal situation is he going to be embarrassed that people know that he did time, you know?
Mm-hmm. One of the, and we're coming near the end of time, and there's just one other angle that I want to explore here, and you mentioned it a little bit earlier, and that is dealing with legal issues. The legal environment in the United States is a lot of walking on eggshells with respect to imposing religion on somebody else. Yeah, and you know, here you are in a very controlled environment. They're basically guys in jail cells, or you know, they can't go out and that. Right. What kind of legal issues do you have to wrangle with?
It seems like sometimes that's all we deal with is legal issues.
It is
heavy. The one thing dealing with the beards and the hair and all that. That I say that because that has been something that has really taken our time away from really important stuff. If I had my druthers, I'd just say, hey, let him grow beards, let him grow hair. I want to deal with weightier matters, but I'm not the final arbiter of that. And I'm not I'm not the director. I've seen the job. I don't want it. They have that job for specific reasons. I let them make those decisions. And so I carry out what their desires are. And their desires right now are that we filter through, we have to make decisions based on whether we think this person is sincere in their religious belief that they need to grow this hair as religious expression. A lot of guys will bring up Leviticus 19:27 about not shaving the sides of their beard or cutting their hair. They'll bring up the Nazarite vow out of Numbers 6. A lot of them will say, well, I'm Islamic, and because of that, I want to grow a beard. All kinds. Wiccan, Odinist, I mean, you name it. We run into it. And it's tough.
Mm-hmm.
It's really tough. And you run into stuff that you have no control over, but yet you could have a lawsuit piled over you. They're piled on your actions or your inability to act, you're still going to be named in the lawsuit. One of the more cynical moments was somebody bringing up to me that the reason the chaplain exists is to keep the Arkansas Department of Corrections from getting lawsuits. And there's a certain amount of truth to that. We're the religious experts, quote-unquote, and we're supposed to help them navigate in areas so that we can keep the legal mountain to a molehill. And it, to a certain degree, you know, we've got to do that. But then there's things that come up, and without getting into specifics, there's, for instance, we might have a Jewish inmate who wants his Passover stuff. Well, if he ordered this thing from this organization from outside, and it was they only gave him part of what he needed. They gave him the Seder meal, but not the entire Passover thing. Well, now he's got a pass that whole time. He's going to be upset about it, and he may say something. Oh, well, what the chaplain do? So we get drawn into that, and along with the beard and whatever else. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff like that that you would think are piddly things. And they're arguing over stuff like a husband and wife might argue over where you squeeze the tube of toothpaste in the bathroom, right? They're arguing over the same level of things, And so there's that. And it's, the stuff where somebody really did mess up, But there's a whole array of stuff that we got to kind of wade through on.
Now, you mentioned you come across Wiccans and Odinists and mm-hmm. other, faiths that you're not necessarily a part of. Do you have to deal with those all the time? And how do you deal with that? I never even thought about that. Yeah.
Yes, and it's really, really strange something. But it is also magnificent in a way. And I say that because of some of the experiences that I've had. We, when I was a CRA at one of the units, I came into a barracks and there was a guy cutting hair in there. There were two Christians sitting there. This sounds like the beginning of a bad joke. Anyway, there's two Christians. One of the guys is cutting the other's hair. there is a black Muslim who comes up to me because he recognizes that I'm a CRA.
But what's so a CRA?
Certified Religious Assistant.
Okay.
And he recognizes I'm carrying a Bible and talking with these guys, and he recognizes me. He asked me about some Bible stuff, and then he brings this paper that is like a leaflet that was dropped on his bunk, and it was your standard racial epithet type stuff against black folk, right? Very white supremacist type of stuff. But it was listing Bible verses. I said, man, that's crazy. Ain't none of that backed up by scripture. They're really having to twist it. He said, well, I mean, this was left on my, and the guy who said it on his bunk came up and started talking. He's Christian identity, right? So now we got three Christians, a Muslim, a Nation of Islam Muslim, right? And a Christian identity Aryan Nation type. And we're all sitting at the table together talking about Bible stuff. And it didn't hit me until an hour later, I was driving out the gate going back home. And I had chills all up and down my arms and legs, realized, oh, crap, that just happened.
Yeah. Wow.
How often does that happen out in the free world?
Yeah, not often. Yeah, people don't sit down like that in very tense situations and deal with heavy issues.
The thing is, they have to sleep in that same room.
Yeah.
They have to sleep in that same room. So rather than having to keep an eye open, which they do anyway, then it's better just, okay, let's deal with this and let's not make this ugly.
Yeah. Yeah, that environment, I guess, can do it for you, and it's an opening in many ways to a lot of things that you can do. So,
yeah,
it's fascinating. Absolutely. We need to wrap up here, and there is one final question
I
want to. Oh no, but this is great. This is the kind of inside stuff that I've always wondered. You know what? You know who does this? What do they do? And those kind of things. And the one question I have to close off with is one that I ask a lot of my guests is that, you know, reflecting back on your past 20 or so or more years doing all of this stuff, what have you learned? And not only just what have you learned, but what have you learned that has really affected the way that you view the world spiritually or the way that you interact with others?
There's three things that have really, in all of this, there's three things that really have impacted. And I've had to grow in all three of these areas. This isn't something that I started out. This is something that I'm at now that I've kind of grown into. But one is being real, which, relating to people as they are and that not as how you wish they were. I was very idealistic, very much, you know, a 60s child kind of, all right, and very, very much, well, this is how things should be. If we could just describe them, and then being extremely disappointed when everybody isn't that way. And I've grown into, okay, let's just start with where you are right now. And then love, regardless, the person isn't the choice that person makes. God doesn't make trash. Now, you might trash yourself, but God doesn't make trash, you know. And then you have more impact than you realize. People are watching you, even if you think they're not. And just a real quick story on that. I had been doing some marriage counseling between the husband and wife. The guy I had worked with an outside job, and this was outside of the prison environment, outside of the jail environment. This was just me talking to a couple of friends that I really, really loved dearly. And the stuff that was going on with Jerry Springer-esque, he was receiving sex tape videos on his phone from the guy with whom his wife was cheating.
Right.
Yeah. And he had a fit of anger and fired off some AR-15 rounds into the floor of their house. I mean, this Jerry Springer crap, all right? heavy stuff. Well, I sat with them and talked with them and cried with them, all that, for about 6 hours on Saturday night. The next morning, I was so torn emotionally, I couldn't even go to church. I could not even show up and worship that Sunday morning. I didn't want to see a person at all. Well, that night, I had to go into jail. So I had finally come down enough to do that. And the message that I had come into the pod with that night, I pretty much threw it in the trash because I needed some ministry that night. Those guys in the jail cell ministered to me. Guys that I had no idea had been paying attention when I'd been coming in and talking. That had been hanging out in their bunk, hanging out by, you know, the rail of the upper floor, whatever, were coming by me and talking to me and saying how much what I had done for them mattered to them. And then they were giving me the spiritual food that I really needed at that moment. And that's, you know, you get fed by these guys just as much, if not more, than what you give to them. This reciprocity thing is, I mean, it's amplified, you know. And so I say that to say that these guys, I had no idea that they were paying attention, were paying close attention. Problem is, they didn't want to be seen to be taking part in the Bible study because of their own, you know, they're trying to look tough or whatever. But they were listening. They were absolutely listening. And they let me know it.
That is such a cool story that I think we got to end it here because I don't know how you can top that story. It just tells you the lesson that ministry is a two-way street. It's not just from the pastor to the congregants. It's the congregants to the pastors as well. And, you know, and of all the environments, a prison environment, a Jerry Springer type of environment, that kind of it comes out, which is very cool.
Well, that's okay. And one last thing. These guys are very protective.
Mm-hmm.
They're incredibly protective. We're going over, I'm sure. But these guys, I have been told stories where, you know, they would have prison riots, Oklahoma, Texas, whatever. And if there's a religious worker in there, they will cordon the area off. The inmates will do this. The inmates will do this. They'll circle the wagons around these people and make sure that they don't get hurt. Inmates and guards getting killed left and right, but the religious workers are not being hurt. They are buried. Messing with a religious worker is like being a child molester prison. You get retribution quickly. And that is the criminal ethic that, you know, there's no ethics among thieves. Well, no, yeah, there is. That's one thing that they're very serious about.
It just tells you.
I feel absolutely safe.
Yeah. It just tells you how much that even in individuals' darkest moments, there's always the glimmer of hope that our spiritual life really, really matters. And we have to take great care with it. My guest today has been Jeff Hennig. He's a prison chaplain out there in Arkansas. Jeff, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
And thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.